This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio, heard weekdays from noon to one. Now, Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome. It's Thursday, time to talk about all things municipal. And a lot of people are skeptical about the unusually low property tax hike proposal in this election year. Now, the full budget, Toronto budget that is, was to be released this morning, but so far I have not seen that much information on how the budget shortfall will be covered. Now, we have just heard that the city has made a deal with the federal government to cover the costs of housing refugees, which has been a key irritant. And the budget chief, Shelley Carroll, says the city is in talks with the province about more revenue tools that would provide sustainable models of funding. In the past, the ideas for this have included a special Toronto tax tacked onto the HST, or steep parking levies for businesses, as well as special hotel taxes. Now, the only declared mayoral candidate, Brad Bradford, worries that that budget balance will be accomplished by dipping into reserves. We'll be talking to him very soon, as well as the other panelists. But what do you think? Text us at 866-740-4740.
And now it's time to tune into the town.
And now I'd like to welcome John Burnside, City Councillor for Ward 16, Councillor Brad Bradford, Ward 19, Beaches East York, and the only declared mayoral candidate for the next election, and former City Councillor Karen Stintz. Hi, everyone. Happy New Year to all of you.
Hi, Libby. Happy New Year.
Thank you.
Happy New Year, Libby. I'm not sure how long we get to keep doing that, but I think today's still good. So Happy New Year to everyone.
Yeah, I am told that we can keep saying it until January 15th, which is Monday, I think, or it's soon anyway. So happy New Year. And is this like a New Year's gift, John, that we have this lower property tax hike, much lower than people were expecting, and also apparently some kind of deal with the federal government?
Yeah, so I mean, it's interesting that the mayor has found fiscal frugality in an election year. And if that's truly the case, then I applaud her, you know, like live within our means. I don't think it changes the fact that she's raised taxes almost 17% over the last 2 years and things haven't really improved. So she's saying, well, we're going to do more of the same, but we're not going to increase taxes more than inflation. So people are still faced with an additional burden every year going forward and nothing's improved. But that aside, my concern is this is a little bit of a shell game, and it could be a big shell game. So, for instance, one of the things they're doing is taking out of the rainy day fund of the TTC reserves. I think it's about 33 to 35 million. Brad will know all those numbers. He's a lot smarter than me. But that's a one-time thing, and 35 million is almost a 1% tax increase. So they've forgone that 1% by dipping into the piggy bank. They've also changed the board at the parking authority, so it's now a city-run function. And instead of funding the capital repairs and improvements through profit, they're now doing it through debt. So instead of giving the city 75% of their profit and then keeping that 25% to actually improve the parking lots, they're giving us all their profit. So that, once again, I think that's 10 to 15 million. But they're adding to the debt load of the city. Those are just two examples of things that are troubling me. I really think that this may not be so much fiscal frugality as it is a shell game.
Brad, you have thoughts on this too.
Well, the number John was looking for, he was pretty close. It's $35 million that she's raided from the reserve account for the TTC. Also instituted a fare freeze on that. And you have to ask the question, is that sustainable for the third year in a row when ridership continues to lag behind 2019 numbers? But, you know, John's right. I find it pretty rich that here we are on the eve of an election and suddenly the mayor has found some fiscal restraint. But I would suggest that a leopard doesn't change their spots and a tax hiker doesn't change their ways. After delivering two of the biggest tax increases in Toronto's history, I'm worried that today Mayor Chao is mortgaging Toronto's future to pay for her re-election prospects in the fall. And to give our listeners a sense of the order of magnitude, they are in the budget committee meeting right now. And we just heard from staff that $516 million this year is a bridging strategy that they are achieving through, quote, temporary fixes and financing changes. So those were some of the things that John alluded to. But, you know, $500 million, that's nearly 10% tax hike right there.
So
you know,
just a minute, a bridging strategy for the shortfall.
But yes. And to be able to deliver an inflation tax increase this year, they are going to have to bridge $516 million, of which $323 million is short-term actions drawing down on the reserve account. That's literally coming up in the meeting right now as we're speaking. So $323 million, I'm doing the math right now, that's roughly a 6.5% tax increase right there. So she is very much smashing open the piggy bank to pay for her reelection prospects in the fall. But again, I don't think Torontonians are going to fall for it. They know Olivia Chow's inclinations. She is a tax hiker. She's done that every year she's been on council. And this is the stuff that makes people cynical on politics, unfortunately. We will be paying for it in the future. And my goodness, if she's reelected, Torontonians will really be paying for it next year.
Okay, Karen, what do you make of it? And also, what about this deal about paying for the costs of housing refugees?
Well, I think that is, in terms of paying for the cost of refugees, that is a federal responsibility, that they are responsible for, ensuring that refugees have a place to come to Canada. But, you know, the city can't pay for those shelter costs. We just can't on the tax base. So that is just, I think, a proper alignment of responsibilities for what the federal government should be doing. It's just curious. It's curious in so many ways, Libby, but, it begs the question, the tax hikes that we saw the last couple of years, again, we still don't really know where that money went because, as John said, nothing's, to my eye, has improved other than libraries are open longer and, kids at camp are getting snacks. But, and apparently we pay people more. It's a question of, what did that money do? Like, where did it go? And then the other interesting thing about the city is it passes its budget without actually reconciling last year's results. So we don't know if the city actually has an operational surplus that it just doesn't go reported because we don't get that information. And so, back to being a shell game, money is coming in, money's going out. We don't know how much. We know how much money's coming in. We don't know how much money's going out. We don't know what happens. But we budget each year as if things continue to go up, when in fact, we don't actually know if that's the case. So there's a lot that needs to be done on the city finances to be transparent. I don't believe they are. And there's also, a question of, they did raise the hotel tax to the highest in the country under the auspices of supporting the World Cup. Recycling has come off the tax bill. Notionally, I know there's some problems with the recycling in the short term, but notionally that cost is no longer absorbed by the city. There was some uploading of responsibilities with respect to the DVP and certain areas of, other highways, so that there's costs that have come off the city books. And so there's a real reconciliation that needs to happen to understand, what is the true cost of governing the city, and what is really the, do we expect taxpayers to absorb?
Well, yeah, it depends how you govern, I guess. There's also word, John, that from the budget chief, Shelley Carroll, that she's talking to the province about new revenue tools. This comes up every now and again. And there's talk about getting a penny, excuse me, of HST, whether it's an additional penny or one of the pennies. There's talk about taxes on every parking spot that every business has. You know, we've heard a lot of these things before. What do you make of that?
Well, I'm hoping she gets nowhere with that. I'm a big fan of Shelley's, but this whole idea of revenue tools that's unique to the city of Toronto is problematic. If it's the GTA, I could probably get my head around it. But here's the problem. The city of Toronto, here's just one example, offers about 10 times the number of shelter spaces relative to their population compared to any other municipality in the GTA. There's no way we have 10 times the homegrown homelessness problem in terms of people not being able to get good jobs, drug addiction, mental illness, whatever it is. These things should all be proportionate. They're not. Toronto bears the brunt of a lot of social infrastructure. And housing is another example. We provide housing, affordable housing for people, 20% of whom aren't even from Toronto. So we can't burden Torontonians with these costs that are really GTA or provincial wide and expect Torontonians to pay for an extra with an extra percent of sales tax or whatever the case might be. And of course, if you think of a business, a car dealership on the south side of Steeles, well, who's going to go to that car dealership and pay 1% more when they can go on the north side and pay 1% less?
Well, exactly. Brad, what's your view of revenue tools? I mean, if you become mayor, will you be going for more sustainable revenue tools?
I think the bigger thing is, where can we work with the province and the federal government to offload some of the expenses that have historically been downloaded to municipalities, where we are not really best positioned to fund those things? And Karen's right, you know, dealing with refugees and asylum seekers, Toronto's always left holding the bag for that. But of course, that's a decision that has nothing to do with our level of government. So that's not sustainable. When you look at the challenges in terms of operating costs for the TTC, you know, it has the highest percentage of fare box revenue, you know, of any major transit system in North America. And it has very little support from other levels of government. And, you know, like the province and the feds would both say that they want to do things on climate change. Supporting people getting on transit is a great way to alleviate congestion and, of course, help out the environment. So there's a role to play there as well. And historically, the province was more involved in that than they are now. And by the way, that's been a change that was, you know, 30 years ago. So it's not this government. So that's where I would go, rather than how do we start making things more expensive in Toronto and less competitive in Toronto. We got a real affordability challenge right now. People are really feeling it in their wallets and their pocketbooks. It's never been more expensive to live in this city. It's never been more difficult or burdensome to run a business. And we have to look long-term down the road here. How do we continue to make Toronto a destination for capital, for investment, for talent, and continue to attract people who want to make a bet and build a business and take a risk? They got to do it here in the city, and more taxes makes us less attractive, not more attractive.
Karen, we have a new traffic czar, and the word is that he actually knows what he's doing.
Isn't it great? It's fantastic. So, yeah, hopefully we'll see, you know, particularly in a lead up to the World Cup, again, which is a different beast than the Parapan Games. But it's great. I think he comes in with a strong resume, great experience, and Torontonians have, I think, you know, we're not going to eliminate congestion. We need to be reasonable, but there are some things that just don't make sense in the city. And if he can start to crack some of those roadblocks, as it were, to get people moving, I think it's all to the good. So I think it's pretty exciting.
And do you think that he'll bring back those HOV lanes?
From the city's perspective, whether he has the authority to do that within his remit, I don't know. I am actually a strong believer in congestion pricing. I think it makes sense. Obviously, the current premier has strong views against that, which would make it hard to implement. But I think there's lots of creative things he could do, and that would make a real difference in the city.
John, I mean, you keep saying that things have not improved in the city, and they haven't. And one of the key areas where things have not improved yet is congestion. Are there any kind of measurable outcomes that are related to the hiring of Mr. Poslins, or and should there be?
Well, there should be, but I'm not an expert as to what you're going to measure. And one of the big problems, of course, is construction and all the variables that go with it. So I'm not sure what you could measure, but of course, that's why people such as him are hired, to figure out what those parameters are and how we can judge him and the work of his, I'll say, newly created office. But I would like to touch on something Brad said also about the TTC. You know, we're freezing fares, but a lot of the people who use the TTC don't need their fare frozen. And a lot of people who would use it would use it if it were safer and more reliable. So we have this thing called a fare pass system. So if you can't afford the $3.30, you can apply for this fare pass, and it reduces it to, I think, about 2.25. So that's actually helps people who need the help. And everyone else, we should at least be keeping pace with inflation so that we can make some of these investments to make the system safer, to make it more reliable. And then people would actually take the TTC. I've never heard someone say, well, if they raise it to $3.50 from $3.30, I'm not going to take it. But I hear a lot of my friends say, I'm not taking it because I don't feel safe and it's not reliable.
Well, speaking of not feeling safe, in the last couple of days alone, we've had stabbings and a killing on the TTC. I mean, it's no surprise, Brad, that people don't feel safe.
Yeah, and yet you've got the Mayor Chow and her administration out trying to gaslight everybody into believing that, you know, things are a lot better in Toronto right now. And while that might be one element of it, data in a spreadsheet, I can tell you the folks that I'm hearing from every day feel like things are more precarious, less safe, they're more vulnerable, and the city has been slow to respond, you know? And so you see it play out on transit, perhaps more publicly than anywhere else. You're right. There was just a stabbing and homicide on TTC. We had somebody, I believe, shot on a GO bus out of Yorkdale, first homicide of the year. And, you know, in both cases, it may in fact be the case that, some of these individuals were out on bail for other violent offenses. So that's not something that we control, but there is still a huge problem in this country with respect to bail reform, the Youth Criminal Justice Act, and we need some strong changes so that when people commit crimes, they are arrested and they actually stay in jail. That is continues to be a problem. But I would be really cautious. I would offer a word of caution for politicians out there that are trying to take a victory lap on the safety file right now, because that is not how people are experiencing the city. And, you know, as a son of a single mother and the father of two girls, we have to do a lot more to make sure that vulnerable people, women on transit, are feeling safe and secure, because ridership numbers will continue to lag. It's not about the cost of taking transit. It's about the service that's not reliable and the lack of safety when you're actually using the facilities.
Yeah, and just a program note, people out there, Brad was talking about suspects being out on bail. We're going to be talking about that in the next segment because, of course, the person arrested in this horrible random killing of a 20-year-old student who had his whole life ahead of him was out on bail, and not for nothing, but for firearms offenses. It just boggles the mind, and it keeps on happening. And yeah, I guess it's one thing that we cannot blame Olivia Chow for. But again, this Karen, this issue of safety on the TTC. I mean, I don't know. Do you feel safe on the TTC?
I don't take the TTC that often, and I can say, well, I have seen some improvement to where it was even a year ago. it's still a problem. And it you know, there is this acceptance that, you know, people can use the TTC for shelter, and it shouldn't be used that way. And then when we have incidents like this, as Brad was alluding to, you know, they may be isolated, but the experience of someone who can make a choice of whether they want to take the TTC or not is going to choose no, because even if it is isolated, it could happen. And there is a pervasive sense that there is not that there is not the controls and the safety and the security that once existed in the TTC that are going to draw people back to it. And so, you know, I think the fares actually are important, because we do see there is a maximum. You can raise the fares before people start to choose other options. And then, you know, I think that we shouldn't be have a deaf ear or not pay attention to fares and how they increase. But I do agree very strongly that the priority for the TTC needs to be reliability, and it needs to be safety and security.
What about, I mean, the TTC, you can still be a child going for free, and you can still, you know, mm-hmm. be a very large 18-year-old who says he's 12.
I know, it's bananas. And that kind of thing has to stop. Like, we just need to go back to, you know, appreciating that that policy, while well-intended, has a lot of pitfalls that are playing out in very bad ways for the system.
Also, we mentioned that recycling has left the city's coffers. Now, I know it's not a city thing. One of the things that I'm really confused about, because, you know, there were a lot of missed deliveries, and a lot of people who think that the city should directly deliver every service, but GFL, the company that missed these pickups under the new system, well, they're the same company that does the pickup, certainly on the west side of the city, that was contracted by the city. So can anybody shed any light on that? Brad?
Well, I'm in the catchment area where GFL operates, and my recycling was picked up, no problem. I had no issues with the recycling pickup, although I don't know if it actually gets recycled. I think it probably all goes to the same landfill, but that's another conversation.
In my part of town, we will have recycling coming through tomorrow, so I'll let you know how it goes. But I would say it's an interesting time of year to roll this out. The first sort of garbage pickup after the holidays is you know, normally one of the biggest ones of the year. So I don't think they did themselves any favors starting it at the beginning of January. But I would imagine, you know, GFL certainly knows how to take out the trash. They've been doing it for a long time. They're probably one of the biggest companies in the country that does this stuff. I would imagine they will be able to sort this out. But it's unfortunate, again, for taxpayers, for Torontonians right now. These are the basics that the city continues to fall down on. And no one really cares if it's the province or the city or whatever. They just, they just want their garbage picked up.
Well, Thursday is our garbage day. So when I get home, I will find out if it went as usual. I think the issue with the pickups that didn't happen were that they were special pickups, additional pickups, and there was some confusion there. So bottom line, Brad, what do you tell people? I mean, you know, as you said, this increases cynicism. Great, we have a lower tax hike. In an election year, of course, the mayor hasn't said if she intends to run again, but I'd say this is a pretty big sign. But what should people be looking for?
Well, look, this is an election budget, and that is where the cynicism starts to go through the roof, because let's all remember who Mayor Chow is. She is a tax hiker. That is core to who she is. It's always been her approach to government. There's never been a tax that she didn't love and rush to implement and then raise again, which we've seen time and time again. This doesn't change Mayor Chow's approach to financial mismanagement. It's just the first 2 years she did it with record-breaking tax increases. And this year, she's mortgaging the future to pay for her reelection prospects in the fall. As we're sitting here having this conversation, I'm just doing the quick math on it. And again, her rating of the reserves, the rainy day fund, the emergency fund at the city of Toronto, when you're over $320 million, that's a 6.5% tax increase. You couple in the $35 million that she rated from the TTC, that's almost another point. The rating of the capital reserves and the Toronto Parking Authority, all of this, what they will call balancing and bridging strategies, it's a one-time payment for this year. So let's just have eyes wide open what she's doing. Let's be, you know, honest and transparent with Torontonians. And if Mayor Chow is reelected after she's done this, you better believe your tax bill is going to go through the roof in 2027.
Speaking of the parking, John, so one of the things, the theories going around with that was that that the city actually wants to get rid of parking because we know only bad people drive, and sell the land to developers to raise some money. Is that just a conspiracy theory, or have you heard that?
Yeah, so I don't know that it's a conspiracy theory per se, but I did speak to a counselor, and I won't mention that counselor's name, but I said, you know, I one of the things to reduce congestion, whether we like it or not, would be a congestion tax like they use in London, England. And this counselor has said to me, no, he said the best, and this person is definitely left of center, he said the best approach is to eliminate all parking, because if you don't have parking, cars have nowhere to go when they come downtown. So I don't know that it's widespread throughout the Chow administration, but definitely people on the left side of the ledger are talking about it.
And I'm just curious, how do councillors get around and get to their events, and the mayor as well? I mean, there's a lot of fanfare when we see her on her bike, but I'm assuming that she gets driven to a lot of places, Brad.
Yeah, she has a police detail, a couple cars that drive her around. I'm not sure how often she's taking transit. I'm not sure how often she's driving or riding a bike, but she does have a police detail, and that's standard for any mayor. You know, for me, it's like a lot of Torontonians. It's a combination of things. You know, I will drive, especially as a father of two young girls, doing daycare and school drop off in different locations. My wife is going to different construction sites across the city. Transit is an option sometimes when your destination is on transit, but we haven't built enough transit in the city, and it's not particularly safe or reliable. So that doesn't always work. And, you know, last year I still rode 5,500 kilometers on the bike. So I get around that way a lot also, but not because I'm an ideologue about it. It's because the traffic is so bad and the transit is so unreliable. That's often the easiest way for me to get downtown from where I am. But let's remember, that's about 2% of the trips in Toronto. So that is not reflective of how most people get around. And the idea of eliminating parking downtown to make it harder for people to drive, we just have to be clear-eyed and sober. Until we build out the transit and we can get it functional, like a city like New York or London, all these other Singapore, these places that we point to, our transit network is a fraction of what those cities have. So the reality is people are going to be driving in Toronto for a long time, and we have to stop doing things that makes it more difficult to do that.
Okay, not to mention small businesses will suffer if the parking is all taken away. I'm looking at the clock. We're out of time. I am sure that more gory details about this budget will be coming out as we see the results of the meetings that are happening right now. But in the meantime, thank you so much for giving us some clarity on it. John Burnside, Brad Bradford, and Karen Stintz. And we'll talk again soon. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay, people, we are taking a quick break. And when we come back, as I mentioned, boy, another suspect charged with capital first-degree murder, also out on bail after allegedly killing a 20-year-old randomly when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Oh, no. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, yesterday, police arrested a suspect in the apparent random killing of a 20-year-old international student from India. Shivank Avasthi was shot on a trail on the campus of the Scarborough University of Toronto on December 23rd. And once again, there is the disturbing news that the suspect, 28-year-old Babatunde Afuape, was out on bail for firearms offenses. Why does this keep happening? You can text us at 866-740-4740. And let's bring in Clayton Campbell, president of the Toronto Police Association. Hi, Clayton.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Happy New Year, but this is very, very sad, sobering news indeed. What's your reaction?
Yeah, First of all, just a horrible situation. I watched the news conference yesterday with Detective Sergeant Stacey McCabe, who is one of our best investigators at the Homicide Squad, detailing what happened. And what was chilling for me was that they say it might just be completely random. And so I can't imagine some of the fear and apprehension the students have at the U of T Scarborough campus hearing this has happened. But again, very proud of the members of the Homicide Squad that worked, as she described, day and night to make the arrest of this individual.
They didn't say it might be random. My take on what I heard yesterday was that it definitely was random.
Yeah, when I watched the news conference, that's what the detective sergeant said. They had no information to say that it wasn't. So when you hear something like this, very scary, right? It's someone that wasn't targeted. There wasn't some sort of an altercation led to it, just a random murder of somebody. And so a really disturbing situation is, and I listened to your lead in hearing that they're potentially either out on bail or parole brings, that question back into the public discussion.
So here's a question. Do we know if this suspect is a Canadian citizen?
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. What I know is really what I learned from that news conference and the detective sergeant talking about the fact that he was out on parole for a firearm offense. So we come back around and say clearly the parole system didn't work. When you have somebody out on parole for a firearm offense only to go on and murder somebody else. I was in contact with the Public Safety Minister of Canada today, actually, about this, Minister Ansangri, to talk about my concerns again around parole. We have Bill C-14 that's making its way through Parliament, but still parole has to be dealt with because there are huge issues with the parole system in Canada.
I mean, you would think that a firearms offense is serious enough to keep someone in jail, no?
Yeah, I mean, time and time again, we see people out, if it's on bail or parole, when they're involved in either murders or shootings. And, you know, I've been very clear on this. Let's keep the bad guys in jail. And we've been tough on crime type approach that we need changes to the bail system, that we're glad to see Bill C-14, as I mentioned, making it through Parliament. But we need to keep the citizens of Toronto safe. We see poll and poll again, time again, and I'm sure on your radio station, where people are fearful of crime. They're fearful of some of the violence we're seeing, and it's really concentrated with a small number of individuals. So I was happy to re-engage the public safety minister again to say, listen, let's have a conversation about how we change the parole system. We're proud to represent the family members of fallen officers, Hancocks, Bayless, Michael Sweet. Those names may resonate with some of the citizens of Toronto, where those family members are re-victimized time and time again, where they have to go before the parole board to keep these violent cop killers in custody. And that's not fair to re-victimize those individuals.
Are you satisfied with your reading of the proposed bill that this would not happen if and once this bill is passed, the new one?
So C-14 mostly deals with bail. My understanding is this individual is out on parole. So there would be no impact with C-14 when it comes to this individual, if I'm right, that they were out on parole. And, you know, when I spoke to Sean Fraser, who's the Attorney General of Canada, and the Public Safety Minister, along with Ruby Sahota, who's the Secretary of State for Combating Crime, we were very happy to see they were working on bail. And we really want to see both parties come together and get C-14 passed, but it doesn't address the parole system. So they've committed to me to work on this as in this new year. So again, I was in contact with the public safety minister this morning about this case specifically.
My final question again about the citizenship. I mean, it's very hard to know. The name is from the person's name. But do we deport non-citizens who commit crimes? Because that also seems to happen a lot.
Yeah, it does. Obviously, they're held accountable first in Canada, and then they're deported. But, you know, I've been clear on this, too. If someone comes to the country and wants to commit violent offenses, let's kick them out. We don't need people like that in our great country. We have so many, the vast, vast, vast majority of immigrants come here, work hard, and make a better life for them and their families. And those are the type of people we want. So we've always been supportive of someone commits a violent offense, really any offense, they should be returned to their country where they came from.
And does that happen reliably? I mean, what kind of fixing does that need?
Yeah, you know, I don't want to kind of shoot from the hip, as you'd say, and guess on some of that stuff. I'm not sure exactly how that process works, but I know that if someone, as an example, is not a citizen of Canada, they're here on a visa or something, and they're involved in criminality, that CBSA and the appropriate authorities are advised of that, and then they're removed. But again, I think with this case, what is really troubling for me is that if this individual was in fact out on parole for a firearm offense to be let out and commit a murder, allegedly commit a murder, that's a huge problem, and we need a fix in the parole system.
Okay, Clayton Campbell, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You too. And now let's go to Kim Schofield, who's a criminal defense lawyer with Kim Schofield and Associates. Hi, Kim. Okay, we are waiting for Kim to come back on, people. Let me give the text numbers again. What do you think? I mean, how many times do we have to hear about a suspect in a serious crime, either out on bail or parole? And we have Kim Schofield back now. Hello, Kim. Do we have Kim? Oh, she needs to unmute herself. Kim? Okay. Again, the text line is 866-740-4740. And we're just waiting for Kim Schofield to unmute herself. We've been talking about this extremely disturbing case of a suspect arrested for a seemingly random killing. According to police, this suspect, 28-year-old Babatunde Afuape, went to the U of T Scarborough campus that day with the intention of killing someone. No idea why he picked 20-year-old Shivanka Vasti. They were not known to each other, according to police. But this is obviously a very dangerous person, allegedly, coming onto a campus with the idea of a random killing. The whole idea of that, to me, is just chilling. So, again, the text line is 866-740-4740. And I think we have Kim Schofield now. Hello, Kim.
Yes. Hi. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you now. What is your reaction to this?
Well, it is extremely concerning. I mean, any homicide at all is concerning, but this one in particular, because there seems to be a stalking of some sort or a watch and beset of some sort. The police do not know, at least now, the degree to which these two are connected, if they are in fact connected at all. So very concerning, scary situation. I mean, whether there's a connection there or not, it's a scary situation. So the police, I'm sure, are working diligently, and they have these days a considerable amount of resources at their disposal, video-wise, social media-wise, phone-wise. If there's a connection, I'm confident they'll find one.
Okay. I have some questions. So we were just talking to Clayton Campbell, and he underlined that this type of situation would be avoided if a suspect was out on bail. But his understanding is that this suspect was out on parole. So the new law wouldn't catch that necessarily.
No. So the parole aspect, I mean, that's another aspect that I would say, yes, is concerning. But the way that parole works in this country is it's supposed to ease someone back into society while still providing supervision and support. That's the concept. In this case, of course, he's on parole for gun-related offenses. So presumably someone with access to firearms, obviously, and proven to have such in the past. But, I mean, parole-wise, people get out and are supervised in the community. Now, of course, his parole is revoked. But I'm not sure that, I mean, maybe stricter conditions or more monitoring, like the use of electronic monitoring, would have acted as a deterrent in a case like this. So we see electronic monitoring being used increasingly in bail, but not as much in parole, although it's not unheard of. But that's something that certainly if someone knew they were being tracked, it is much less likely they would commit a violent offense, especially one that is planned and deliberate.
And do we know if this suspect is a Canadian citizen?
No, we do not know that at this point. But presumably, if they didn't have status either as, well, presumably if they weren't a citizen, I'll just extrapolate on this, then they would be subject when you commit a violent offense, for which you receive over 6 months in actual custody, it is deemed serious criminality and you will be subject to removal. And then there's appeal periods, of course, but during that time, you would be subject to some form of immigration bond. So because this individual was released and we haven't heard anything about any corresponding immigration issues, presumably he's a citizen. Because if he was landed and he was subject to a lengthy term of imprisonment for which he would be on parole, then he would be on some form of immigration bond, and I'm sure we would have heard about that.
Okay, because we've also heard about people getting their sentences reduced for violent offenses so that it wouldn't hurt their immigration status.
Yes. So let's say we can talk about that, but there's cases from the Supreme Court of Canada that say that it must be considered. However, meaning immigration status. So, however, a sentence cannot be unfit. So, for instance, if the appropriate sentence range was between 6 months to 9 months or a year, then the court would say, let's go 6 months less a day so that he would not be deemed inadmissible immigration-wise. So because it's still in the range, maybe he would have to, there'd be some other form of, some other punitive form, but to keep him under the 6 months, but not a sentence that would be inappropriate.
Okay. On that note, we wrap things up. Thanks so much, Kim Schofield. Bye-bye.
Yes, bye-bye. Thank you.
All righty. We are taking a break, and it's the new year. A lot of people have made a resolution to eat healthier. Well, there are some new regulations designed to help us do that. There are new food labels, and we'll talk about how and what to read them with when we return.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. Fight Back with Libby Znaimer on Zoomer Radio.
Welcome back. Well, it is a new year, and there are some new regulations designed to help those of us who are trying to eat healthier. There are new nutrition labels on many packaged foods, and here to help us decipher them, we have Nishta Saxena, who's a registered dietitian and nutritionist and the founder of Vibrant Nutrition. Hi, Nishta. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Libby. Great to be here.
Okay, so what are we going to see on what kind of packaged foods?
Well, essentially, these new labeling is going to try to highlight some of the things that we want Canadians to have less of in their diet. And even though currently the Nutrition Facts Panel is a place where you can see that information, the new labels are meant to sort of really put it in your face. If you're choosing a processed food product off the shelf, you're going to want to understand very clearly whether or not it has things like extra saturated fat, high amounts of sugar, high amounts of salt that may affect your health.
Okay, so it used to be that you'd have to look on the back and kind of go down the list. Is it going to be easier for this stuff to, for us to see this?
Yes, exactly. And that is exactly the point, is many, many Canadians actually struggle with understanding that back panel, that nutrition facts panel that's been on packages for many, many years. Because you're right, you have to do a lot of sort of calculation to understand a general diet, to understand where something fits in your diet. The new labels on the front of package will be very visible immediately when you are going to pick up a product. And the idea is exactly that, to have that big, bold label to let you know if you, for instance, are a person that needs to reduce the amount of salt you're eating, it'll tell you instantly this is a product that may not be a great choice for you because it has what is designated as a very higher excessive level of sodium.
Is it still going to show what percentage of your daily intake is in that particular product? What if you're trying to limit your sodium, what are you going to see?
Yes. So what the front of label will do is it will let you know this product is something that sort of like gives you just like a warning, sort of like, okay, if I'm choosing this product, maybe I do need to turn it around because this front of package label is telling me this may be too high in sodium for me. But yes, you're correct, Libby, that when you flip it over, the Nutrition Facts Panel information will still be there. And you're absolutely right that that Nutrition Facts Panel references an average diet, which represents an average diet of 2,000 calories. And it will still list, you know, the milligram amounts of sodium per serving of that product. So you can understand even from that daily value, which is the percent value on the back panel, whether or not, you know, the actual percent value or the actual milligram amount of salt in a product, if you do want to track that.
So, but what's it going to say on the front? Just high in sodium?
Yes, it'll have those exact words, things like high in sodium. It's sort of like a warning, high in saturated fat, high in added sugars. And the purpose is so it instantly alerts you to the fact that this product is perhaps excessively high in one of the things that I would say the almost all Canadians want to reduce in their diet. So the labeling is really meant to highlight the things that we know can have an impact on managing chronic disease or even, instigating chronic disease. So it's really meant to highlight the specific things that Canadians need to be aware of when they're choosing packaged food products.
Well, don't almost all packaged foods, aren't they almost all high in bad stuff?
Well, it's a great point. You know, I think actually over the past 10 years, you know, I've been a clinical dietitian practicing for 23 years. I would say in the past even 7 years, there's been quite a transformation of processed foods because there is a demand from the public to have better options available. And I think food manufacturers and industry see that if they continue to make, you know, products that meet like 1960s guidelines, that their sales may be dropping. And so actually there has been a transformation. There are a lot of really well-designed processed food products. Of course, we don't want the bulk of our diet to be processed food, although unfortunately Canadians are trending that way. There are better quality products available. But to your point, you really do need to be able to read the ingredient list as well as understand some of the nutrition components of a product to know if it's the right choice for you. So the majority of products out there are probably still sitting in that, you know, don't have them as the bulk of your diet. You can have them sometimes, but there are some actually really well-made products out on the market now.
We've been hearing a lot lately about ultra-processed foods and the dangers of ultra-processed foods. So is there anything on the new label that said this is an ultra-processed food? I mean, how do you distinguish between ultra-processed and just processed?
That's a really excellent question and point. No, there will not be the wording that will tell you, for instance, if you picked up a box of powdered mashed potatoes, that is an ultra processed food. It is so far removed from the original food of being a potato that we, you know, it's unrecognizable in terms of that food, and it may have different things, compounds and everything that's occurred to it in its manufacturing. So picking up that box compared to picking up a box of, say, you know, steamed and packaged potatoes in a bag, you won't see processed versus ultra processed. It's a really interesting idea. I think I don't think that'll ever happen because I think it'll be too confusing and too expensive for us to create products that way. But it is something that I think the public has to think about. The majority of what you want to eat, we want that to be as minimally processed as possible. So processed foods are part of life and they fit into the diet. But those ultra processed foods, if you can think of them as, you know, 5, 10, 15 steps away from an original food, a frozen pizza crust compared to, you know, a bowl of cream of wheat or a slice of 100% whole grain bread, they're very, very different. So it's a really interesting point, but people will still have to get, you know, do some research and get some education on products that are considered ultra versus just processed. I mean, canned tomato sauce, which is very nutrient dense, if it's just tomatoes in a can, is a processed food, but it has a lot of beautiful health benefits and it fits into the diet really nicely. So there will remain definitely some education that's required there.
So south of the border, RFK Jr., who a lot of people concerned with health think is a total charlatan, but he released some dietary guidelines. I mean, that more protein. Last year, the big TikTok thing was protein maxing. Apparently, that's kind of over now, but he's been saying people have to eat more protein. Just to wrap things up, what do you think of all of that?
I think the guidelines are, there is a lot to say about it. So in a short minute, I think that the overarching concept of telling people and asking people and showing people to eat more minimally processed food, really highlighting whole foods, I think that's an excellent sort of something to highlight. I will say, however, that those guidelines have not been followed regardless. So the American dietary guidelines were never followed. Most Americans have no idea about them. They don't follow them. They're not taught them. And so the new guidelines aren't necessarily going to have a drastic impact on American health and chronic disease or disease management, unless there are some strategies put into place to help people be able to use these guidelines. So I think it's all well and good to highlight less processed food. I think that's great. I think that there's also some issues around how people will be able to access and strategically apply these new guidelines to their own lives. So I think I like the fact that the protein recommendations have been increased. I think that is something that is absolutely scientifically makes sense. However, you can write all the guidelines you want, but if most people can't understand them or can't afford food to follow them, They don't really serve much of a purpose.
Okay. Well, it's an interesting and ongoing conversation. Thank you so much, Nishtha Saxena. And we'll talk again soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Okay. That is all the time we have for Fight Back for today. It's good to be back here at the Plex after a restful holiday. And I'll be back here tomorrow.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Fight Back on Zoomer Radio. Heard weekdays from noon to one. This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.